Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Lone Star Capital Podcast. Of course, I am joined by Rob Beardsley, the co-founder and principal of Lone Star Capital. I, myself, Craig McGrother, the director of business development, and one of the straws that stirs the Lone Star drink, a very, very pivotal partner to Lone Star Capital, the one, the only, Alan Steinberg with Park Row Equity Partners. Thank you so much for being here on the show and donating some more precious time to our relationship and to our ecosystem.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me. I always enjoy spending time with you, whether it's here or whether it's on a golf course or at a real estate closing or in Houston or Texas, whatever. It's always quality time when I spend time with Lone Star.
Yeah, well, the feeling is mutual, and personally, it's been really fun to get to know your children, your family, and just really absorbing as much of the information that you so generously share, your thoughts, how you view the world. It really is very important and part of who we are and the fabric of Lone Star. So without further ado, would you mind giving us an introduction about yourself?
Sure. So to give you a little bit about myself on a personal level, so to tell you a little bit about myself personally, I think that's, I'd like to tell you personally about myself before I talk business, is I'm married. I have been married for 34 years. I have 6 children. 3 of them are married. I have 2 grandchildren. One just arrived about 6 days ago. So I'm very excited about that. And family is very important to me. And one of the advantages of being in the real estate world over the past many years, especially when my children were younger, it allowed me to step away from my desk and spend time with my children or go to their schools and so forth. So that's who I am personally. My likes, I enjoy sports very much. I enjoy golf very much. When I was younger, I played a lot of basketball. And I do like to travel,
right?
So that's also.
Wait, just on a personal note, the teams, because you're obviously a New Yorker, and where do you like to go to travel?
Okay, so as a New Yorker, I do love basketball the best, and I am a huge Knicks fan going back to when I was a child. So I remember the good days of the 70s and the great days of the 90s and the heartbreak years over the, you know. And in terms of being a sports fan, I'm a bit of a Long Islander. I like the Islanders, and I like the Mets. And I still follow the Jets. So
right.
That's what it is.
Right. Well, hopefully Aaron Rodgers doesn't blow up his Achilles in the first, for like the 5th play of the season. But we won't talk about that, of course. We'll get into the fun part, which is now.
I actually thought that game was interesting because when I watched that game, I said, oh, wow, I've never seen somebody lose a Super Bowl so early in the season. Right? I mean, basically
yeah.
It was.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It was amazing, right?
Well, it's almost nice that way because as a Niners fan, I'm just get the knife in my kidney every single year where I am so engaged with the whole season. It's our season. It's our season. And then the playoffs roll around and we come up a bit short. And believe me, I'm a very committed fan. So that basically means I get 6 days of the week when it's football season.
Right.
So it almost might be refreshing if we were eliminated right away. Like, for instance,
I hear you.
Yeah, like Jimmy Garoppolo, when he got injured early in one of the seasons, like, okay, great. Well, I don't have to engage anymore. It's fine. Yeah, exactly. I'll focus on golf.
You don't have to
golf.
Deal with the heartbreak.
Precisely.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. But tell us a little bit about, you know, Park Row Equity Partners, the business. Was it always named that? What was your kind of story? Was your family in the real estate world? Can you unpack that, please, if you would?
Right. So the Park Row Equity Partners is really a second generation of a previous company called Park Row South Realty. So about 55 years ago, my father was an accountant, and he had some clients on Park Row. Park Row in the 1970s, ironically, had small office buildings, and a lot of the buildings were being vacated. Why? Is because in the early 70s, the World Trade Center, where we are now, this is the second generation, unfortunately, but the World Trade Center was being built, and everybody wanted to go there. So therefore, there was a lot of vacancy, and there were some buildings available for sale. So my father put together a syndication and bought some properties on Park Row because he thought that those buildings eventually would generate cash flow. So as an accountant, he wouldn't have to, in his retirement, he wouldn't necessarily just have to be an accountant. He would have these buildings generating cash flow for him. So that was Park Row South Realty that was started in 1970. Subsequently, in a few years later, unfortunately, my father died at a young age. And my mother, who's still alive, she's going to be 98 this year, had other people run it, and I was a commodity trader. I have an MBA in finance. And I was a commodity trader on Wall Street, and I wanted nothing to do with the real estate. My father was gone. It was painful. But then eventually I wanted to trade on my own. And my mother said to me, why don't you open up an office in our building? So I went there. And this is 1987, 88, just after the Wall Street crash. And I said to my mother, you know, how much money are you making from this building? And this is a true story. She said, I'm not making any money. She says, it's just, you know, breaking even. The expenses are very high and the tenants are not paying enough. And I just said, you know what? I got an idea. I'll take a leave from absence from my commodity trading. I'll shut down the screens and I'll manage the building. We'll see if we could make it work. And I went back to NYU for some real estate courses, even though I had a master's. And I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed the management of the building. So I managed those buildings to board out some of the investors because it was, you know, we, as I said, a syndication. And my mother and I just became the partners. We bought everybody out. Not because I really thought it was going to be a killing, is I didn't know if it was going to make money and I didn't want to take the people down. One of them was even my grandfather. As soon as I got money, I paid them out. So they got out. So that's how, and I did that for 25 years. Couple of buildings on Park Row, I managed them, and then I started managing some smaller buildings on Long Island.
Right, interesting. And then what year was the transition from commodity trading into going into the real estate world and kind of getting your educational background from, you said, NYU?
Right. So the commodity trading, I was a commodity trader from 1980 to 1987. And when I was a commodity trader, I did travel. I lived in Bolivia for a little while. I went to Chile and so forth. And I traveled around the United States. So I enjoyed it. But I made the transition in 1987, 1988. And that's when I was at NYU. And one of our tenants on Park Row, at the time, people thought they owned all the buildings, was a company called J&R Music World. If you're from New York, they closed about 10 years ago, but if you're from New York, you knew about J&R Music World. They were bigger than Best Buy and Circuit City and all the other electronic stores, and they eventually wanted to have all the stores on Park Row. And I leased them, and whatever they wanted, I leased to them, and I got certain guarantees and so forth. And that worked great. They had full page ads in the Wall Street Journal. But then in 2013, 14, they called me up and they said, whether it be Amazon or whether it be other things that they needed to close up. I thought that was like terrible because I gave them a lot of the property. And they said they wanted to redevelop and they wanted me to partner with them. And I said, well, you've been our tenant for 40 years, and I don't know if I want to just partner in a development project with you. So I actually hired an architect to see if I could build on our own. And at that time, 2014, the financial district was becoming a place where people wanted to live. And therefore, to build an office building in this place didn't make sense, but to build a residential building made sense, and even a small one. And that's what I decided to do, and that's why I created something called, I actually interviewed and we had a major broker find us a partner and we developed the property. I cashed out most of my money, but we created something called Park Row Equity Partners, meaning that instead of taking my money, and it was a lot of money at the time, it's a lot of money still today, instead of taking it and paying the capital gains and just putting it in CDs, and a lot of people advised me to do that, by the way, okay, I decided to hold on to the money and do a 1031. Which was very complicated to do, especially that kind of money. But I did a 1031, and I bought three properties, not just in New York, but I bought them outside the outside of New York at that time.
In New York State or New York City?
Well, I had looked in New York City, and I looked at New York State, and frankly, I looked at New Jersey and Connecticut. I was afraid, as a property manager, to leave New York. A lot of people, if you ask them, they really only want to invest in New York, or they only want to invest in something that they can see. You know, to a lot of New Yorkers, like that famous painting by a guy named Steinberg, you know, the people think it's New York, flyover. Sorry, I know Rob is from California, but the next is California. There's nothing in between.
Basically, gateway market or nothing.
That's correct.
Right.
So a broker and friend of mine introduced me to other people who are investing around the country, and I started to look into that. And the truth is, to invest in New York in 2014 and 15, you were basically getting cap rates like 2.5%, 3%. The interest rates were at 4%. So why were people doing it? A lot of rich families, more than institutionals, were looking to just park money. They needed to park money institutionally. They said, I don't need the cash flow. My children will get the cash flow. I needed the cash flow. So that's really what took me outside of New York.
So you said a lot of very cool things, and knowing your story, timing is a critical element of your story. And one of the timing that you mentioned was your transition from commodities to real estate, really right after Black Monday sometime in, right, 87, I think.
That's correct.
So that's, it seems like great timing, perhaps, to move into real estate. And then also, I think it was great timing that you went from leasing retail space to JNR to doing a development when the financial district was really developing into a great condo market. I mean, it's maybe not a great condo market now, but it's a stronger residential area now. So all those timings are, you know, critical junctures in your story. And then you mentioned 1031 exchange. And then you also mentioned branching out of New York, which you also did at a critical time, which obviously talking about especially COVID, right? New York, getting out of New York and leading you to other parts of the country. So yeah, I think timing is a really important thing. And you obviously can't predict the future, but I think you have a knack for maybe, like Craig likes to say, seeing around corners and knowing where to be.
I'm actually going to piggyback off that to totally agree with your comment and then take it one step further. 2014, you were in mostly, you said at that point,
office space.
So that was exactly you buried the lead there.
True.
Transitioning from office space to multifamily, highest and best use obviously was right. Clear when you're obviously running the numbers with the architect and whatnot, what was possible, the transition in the city from, you know, FIDI being you know, office only to, you know, of course now there's tons of units, but transitioning from office where everyone's taking a massive bath and not a fun bubble bath, but a losing money bath to multifamily and then departing from the state where the laws have obviously changed, we'll get into that later, was a very, very crucial pivot naturally. Yeah,
yes, and actually not only that is that once I got the taste of multifamily, as I told you, I was buying a lot of office buildings on Long Island. And so I started selling all of my office buildings between 2014 and 2017. So I got out of all of the office space. So I guess, Rob, you're right. People have said it that, oh, well, your timing is great. You know, there are a lot of things that went into my decision. Another thing is that a lot of people said to me, instead of just selling out, why don't you just partner with the developer? Leave the money in there and just become part of the development deal. And as you know, a lot of development deals just didn't work out so well. I would have owned office space and condos, retail condos in New York. But I had an experience with somebody in 2007, a friend of mine, lost $750,000 in a development deal. And I kind of look at when I make decisions, and actually this came up in my office today, and perhaps I even with your audience, my commodity trading helped me. Why? Is because when you're a commodity trader, right, prices go up and go down very quickly, not like real estate, but they go up very quickly. That's correct. Here today, gone tomorrow. You have to make decisions very quickly. And I've always been able to make a decision by looking not at my upside, because that's an unknown, protecting my downside. If I could protect my downside, meaning that if I could come up with a scenario that I can live with the loss, then I go forward. So in a development, I couldn't live with the loss, because if the development deal on Park Road didn't happen, I would have been broke. Okay, and I was not going back to being broke. Not that I was ever broke. I always made a fair living, but I didn't want to be broke. So it's not that I wanted to be wealthy. I just didn't want to be unemployed. I didn't want to have a job again. So that was it. And even today when I make decisions, what's your downside? And you've heard me make some decisions. What's your downside? If you can live with your downside, then you protect your downside. So your upside is unknown. So that's why I didn't do the development. With reference to office, I felt that the profits were much more stable in residential. And therefore, no one tenant can hurt you. Commercial tenants had told me that they were leaving. JNR, my biggest one, told me that they were leaving. I had small tenants telling me what they're leaving. Nobody really tells you that in residential. So that's really, I went to play it safe. And while playing it safe turned out to be very, very good for me and for my family.
Well, the other interesting thing as well is when you look at office leases, they're fixed for longer periods of time, as opposed to a tenant can churn through a lot quicker, right? And you can enforce a little bit more appreciation. And it's also the conversation of luxury and necessity, right?
Also, so, yeah. In real estate or in anything, it's all about leverage, right? Who has the leverage? And I felt that in office space, especially when I learned my lesson, is that the tenants have, right? You can give somebody a 10-year lease and they're, but if they want out, all they have to do is either they go belly up or they want out, you'll give them 3 months, whatever, they're gone. But in residential, that doesn't happen. In residential, you have the leverage. What do I mean by that? Is that nobody really wants to leave, and you don't want to send them out, so it's a little bit more even. And I have to have this segment, even to your audience and to you, to say is that, yes, some of my thinking is good, and some of my training is good. There's a tremendous amount of luck, okay? That you know, I said this to my wife just last night. If you make a good decision, and you have good luck, meaning the markets work with you, ah, that's great. If you make a bad decision and the markets are good, a rising tide lifts all ships. If you make a bad decision and the market is bad, that's when it's bad. I have been fortunate enough to make good decisions, and I was fortunate, lucky, that things went my way. When I did this development deal, and my family had owned this property for 50 years. At what point was enough, right? At what point I said, it can go up. The price can keep going up. Maybe 5 years I'll regret that I sold it at a low price. But that was the right move at that time. And therefore, I had to look at it that way. So whenever you make a decision, you have to say to yourself, you know, don't always go for the home run. Sometimes a single or a double works. And even investing in real estate, that's what you have to do. Sometimes, as you know, in some of our deals, they're going to be home runs, right? You can get 3x, 4x your money. Sometimes not. But make sure that you don't lose money. Protect yourself. And certainly, I know that for me, when people invest with me, you know, and I say to them, we don't lose money. I treasure your money. And I do get a sense with Lone Star Capital, and it's going to sound like a commercial, but it's true, is I get a sense that you treat my money and you treat our money very importantly. It's more important than your money, because if you lost your money, you could make it back. If you lost my money, my phone numbers, you won't get my calls anymore. And that's the way of business. And even though you guys probably together aren't my age, I have found a tremendous amount of maturity, Rob, first with you and everybody here, that you understand that, and that you're not in here, you're not like a car salesman where you're putting up a tent, that you want to be around here for the long haul, okay? And you want to build a reputation and you want to build a business, and that's really what I want to do. So I felt that right away there was a tremendous synergy between what you do and what we do. And it had nothing to do necessarily with where we're investing. It had to do with values.
Right, and I really say this, that to me, and we kind of laugh about this every now and then, but it's not a joking matter, my word is my honor and my family's last name, and my dad has built his whole life on building up, I'm getting the chills thinking about this, but his whole life on doing whatever he could to propel us forward and to protect our family's name. So if I call saying this is a really good deal, or if I say, hey, you should go heavy in this, or hey, I think this is a good reel for XYZ reason, and I tell you that, you better believe with full conviction that I mean it and believe it to my core. And that is everything to me, that if I call to say go heavy on something, or this is a really good deal, or watch out for this, I hope you listen and take that as, you know, life and death, important and serious.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just wrote an email late last night to an investor. We're selling a property in Denver. We just sold it. We just accepted the offer yesterday. So I'll have some free cash in June, by the way. And my investor, major seven figures, big investor, 2x their money, okay? And the gentleman who invested with me passed away in 2018. And I said to his daughter, my only regret is that he isn't here to say, oh, hey, Alan, great job. You know, I'm glad I follow your recommendation. Your word is your bond. You were able to deliver what you said, right? Because that's ultimately what you want to do, certainly on a cash flow basis, to you, to your investors, and to me and my investors, and to us. We want to deliver monthly or quarterlies. That's no question about it. We were talking about sports. That's the season. But the Super Bowl is the exit, right? And you want to be there. You want to be able to say to your investors, 3 years, 5 years, you trusted us. Now we can spike the ball. We made it to the Super Bowl, and we're not going to let you down, right? And that investor is not here anymore. So I feel like we can't celebrate together. So I miss that.
Yeah. Speaking of apartments and going to the transition, was there any kind of key component to the apartment world juxtaposed to the office space? I mean, you mentioned some items there, but what made you feel extra bullish on the apartment investment vehicle as opposed to any other real estate asset class out there to park cash in?
What's interesting, so I made those decisions back in 2014 and 15, right? Here's somebody who had completely, I was totally marinated in office and retail. But why did I go to multifamily is that I saw that multifamily at that time, and I believe it at this time, was about as stable as you can get. And therefore, if you say stability, then you look at risk, right? So I felt that in terms of the risk factor, I thought it then, I think it now. You think about office space, you think about retail. Okay, so we know that those have taken a hit. You take an industrial, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal just recently that some industrial now is taking a little bit of hit. There's a little bit of overbuilding and so forth. You know, what's interesting is that I bought some property in Hollywood, Florida last year. Huge deal, right? And I said, I don't know what the market's going to be in 10 years from now or 20 years from now. I don't. I really don't. But I do know that someone's going to want to live in Hollywood, Florida. And I do know that the rents are going to be higher. I don't care what. We could have a recession. We could have a depression. We could have anything. I'm telling you, we'll recover, and the rents are going to be higher. You can't say that with office space. Somebody might not need the office anymore. It could be empty. You go into a retail, it could be empty for a long time. You can go industrial, it's empty. A parking lot. And therefore, I looked at it. If I'm investing, number one is my money. Millions now, not hundreds, but millions, and investors' money, then I have to be extra careful. And I found that multifamily was as safe as you can get. And ironically, it's one of the highest returns. Because even if you could give a cap, you know, an IRR, you know, internal rate of return, a few years ago, 18 to 20 was a sure thing. But if you 15 to 18, or even if you hold the property a bit, little bit longer, you can get a 20% return. 20% return, right? Wall Street would be all over you if you can get 20% return. Madoff went belly up because he was promising people 10% dishonestly, right? So in multifamily, you can give a 15 to 20% return with almost no risk. Why no risk? Because someone's always going to want to live there. And when I invested, especially then, even now, I didn't go to tertiary markets. I went to major cities, Atlanta, Orlando, Chicago, Phoenix, Houston, Dallas, because I don't know the future, but I do know people are going to want to live there. Maybe they're going to pay a lot of rent. Maybe it'll be high class. Maybe it'll be older property. I don't know. And therefore, I feel comfortable about not only investing my dollars because I needed cash flow to take care of my family, but I'll take friends and family. Their money is safe also. Isn't it ironic that it's the safest investment, but can give you the almost highest returns over a shorter period of time? Right. And therefore, multifamily seems to be the safest place, even during COVID, right? COVID was, nobody anticipated that, but still, we went through it. We still collected over 90% of our rents, most of us. It didn't collapse, and so forth.
And the government stepped in and provided a ton of stimulus.
Well, and this goes back
to... They didn't save that's office.
That's good. Why? Yeah. Because people live there.
Well, this goes back to my thesis statement on multifamily juxtaposed to any other real estate asset class, I mean single family, multifamily, but basically, you know, residence, right? Residential. It's luxury versus necessity. You don't need to go in an office building. You don't need to, you know, have a warehouse, but you need a place to live.
Please.
And more of the country than not essentially lives in the workforce housing category, which is renter by necessity, which is precisely what we're buying and what you've invested in with us, which is super crucial. And what you said earlier about returns is a perfect segue to one of the vehicles with the 1031 exchange tax break that you get with the model, which is not only are you getting, you know, outsized returns, you know, the 20%, the mid-teens and whatnot, you know, the Madoff 11, well, we make that an appreciation ideally, but not only getting these returns, but, you know, the structure of the cash flow is also tax-free, but then the gain will also be tax-free via the 1031 exchange vehicle. So can you talk about your history and your love and appreciation for 1031 exchanges, because that was a little bit contentious at the 2022 Lone Star Summit. So I'd love to hear your perspective and how you've been able to utilize that break.
Well, working backwards, if I go back to 2015 or even to last year, the 1031, which is a tax-deferred exchange code, they always talk that it's going to be canceled and going to be canceled. The 1031, ironically, was not necessarily designed for the multifamily investor or the real estate investor. It's really more for the farming families, right? And therefore, generational type of thing. But the 1031 is probably one of the greatest gifts that this country can give to an investor, right? Especially somebody who is an active investor in real estate. Because if I sell a property, which I am, I live on the cash flow. And people should be living on the cash flow. And you can roll that into another deal. But I'd like to say that over the past many years, I've done so many of them that that I have become in somewhat, I don't want to say an expert, I don't like that word, experienced in doing them. So much so that when I did on Park Row, my lawyer said to me, an accountant even said, they're so risky. And why are they risky? They're not risky because there's not upside. There's a clock, there's a timing, right? You have 45 days to identify, right? So that's really what the trouble is, identifying a property. And it's misleading. It's, identify a property. It's not identifying a property. It's identifying a property that you, in fact, want to own.
And to match the debt and equity structure and to basically have everything make sense and be cohesive, right, to fit like a glove.
Right. So and I have done a few of them, but I did a monster one. So, it was huge amounts of money.
Well, and I want to dive into a couple story time, and this is when Rob and you guys can really take it away here, but how we kind of started to do business together, because it was through the 1031 exchange model, and not every syndicator is accommodating of the 1031 exchange tick structure. And I believe, if I have the story straight, which I'm sure you're going to set the record here for all the audience, of course, but of course, you, I think, called Rob saying, hey, I had a problem. We need to identify property and buy one. So I'll let you guys tell your versions of the story here for our audience to rehash that in this forum, which will live on forever. So I'd be very curious to hear that story, the inception of it, what that looked like on both of your perspectives, and also some of the turbulence that came up and maybe a couple other ones as the market shifted and whatnot from a debt perspective in 2022.
Well, yeah, so going back from the very beginning, this has got to be 5 years ago now. I think your son Phil was at a networking event and I was talking about underwriting. So I was on stage sharing a hypothetical deal. And I think we might have exchanged cards, but I don't think there was really a lot of conversation. And then we must have just kept in touch a little bit here and there. And I think two years later, I remember you called me and you said, the emails that you send, the things you put out online are interesting. You've piqued my interest finally. And I'm going to ask you this series of questions. I'm going to do my homework on you. Can you please provide us information? I said, sure, no problem. We provide the information. He said, okay, great. I'm going to test you out. And I think the test was $50,000. And he said, okay, yes, we are grateful for that test. We very much look forward to building the relationship. I hang up the phone and go, awesome. We have a new investor, $50,000. And then I think a week later, you call me again and you say, so I have a problem. You know that $50,000 investment that I'm making with you? I need it to be $6 million.
That escalated quickly, as they say.
It did. And why was that? Why did it go from $50,000 to $6 million? It was, of course, because of a 1031 exchange.
Right. So I had a sale coming through, and I had a short window to do it. I had been involved with a number of other sponsors. I didn't have a property available. I had a short window. And I remember when I came to see you, first of all, it went from $50,000 to almost $6 million. That's true. But during that time is that I did do a lot of due diligence on you. And even though that you were relatively new, you talked about earlier about a good name. You had a good name in the industry, even though it was a new name. And, I spoke to lenders and I spoke to investors and I spoke to other people. by speaking to them, I could hear their voice. Because, you know, if you email people, you can't hear their voice. So I wanted to know if they were telling me the truth. And I do get a sense that they were telling me the truth. And I felt very comfortable with you. And I remember saying to you, are you hard on that deal? Do you have it? Okay, because my window is closing. And you said yes. We were able to get that deal done. And just going back to 1031s is that, and I could share this with your audience because I like to, by the way, is that people think that there's 45 days to identify. And the truth is there's not 45 days. There's a lot more than 45 days, right? There's 45 days from when you sell the property, right? But selling the property is not a surprise, right? Like I just sold a property yesterday. It's going to be at least 30 days, maybe less, 30 days before we're in a contract and it's hard. So I already have 30 days to start looking, right? Then it's probably going to be another 30 days before we close. So that's 60 days that I have before the 45 days start. Why not start looking for properties? So you might say to me, oh, but what happens if you find something that you love? Well, even the government says there's something you could do called a reverse 1031, okay? Well, what happens if I don't have the money for a reverse 1031? Well, that's money that you can borrow because it's good borrow because usually the sale is hard money. So you can get money against hard money and so forth. So if you look at it that way, and not only that is because I sold the property to a developer. So he needed time to work on his plans. So I actually had a put call type of thing. It wasn't a call, it was a put, is that I said to him, can I delay the closing? He said, sure, I don't have to give you the money. I said, good, can I have up to 90 days? Can I have 120 days? I had 6 months. 6 months, you have to realize, it's a huge deal. I had 6 months to do that. So I had almost like 270 days to do that 1031. I said, fine. And that's how I was able to do it. And sure enough, I needed some cash and so forth. And that's how I was able to do it. And even if you're doing a smaller deal, get working on it right away. Get working right away. Don't wait. And also 45 days is not just identifying. It's making sure that you're hard. And when I was in three deals totaling close to $100 million, when I was hard on those three deals, that's when I exercised my option to sell my development property.
Right.
That's a good point that you mentioned, because I don't know if everyone understands that about 1031s, is that you can go from one property and then exchange it into multiple.
Great.
Or do the opposite if you are willing to go through the tenancy in common structure, which I know you use the experienced word rather than expert. You know, we'll humbly say that we're experienced in that as well. And that has paid dividends for us, not just for you, but for us as well, as we've done many 1031 exchanges with investors like yourself.
Right. I also want to give Kent some shine here in this equation, because, of course, you're very public-facing. Kent is not public-facing. We finally convinced him and wooed him to come onto the show, and he said yes. We're very grateful for that. But how did Kent also play in the role, outside of you having a really good name? But there's more than one person and party involved, and I really want to give him some shine. So how did he make you also confident and comfortable with working through that process, considering his very prestigious background?
Well, that's good. You know, what's interesting is that Rob was very young, still young,
still
young, and he didn't have as much experience you have now,
right.
More so. And that was concerning to me, not because you just didn't have the experience, right? You didn't have, it's like the balance sheet or the resume and so forth. So Kent being a little older, and he's still young, by the way, but still
he's in his 40s for the record.
Exactly right. Yeah. He's still seasoned. I felt comfortable with him. Okay, and his background that helped a lot. Okay, I have invested with all kinds of people and all kinds of backgrounds. The fact that Kent happened to be Jewish and religious, which I am, which is unusual. You never know. It was just another comfort level. So it was just giving me a comfort level. He spoke the same language. He was sensitive to some of my sensitivities. So that made it easier. So a combination of the two, okay? The Batman and Robin in different ways. Who was Batman and Robin is not so important. But the both of you offered something to me that just gave me a tremendous amount of comfort, okay? And that I've gotten to know both you and Kent over the years, and now your team, I'd have to say that you've only confirmed what I felt at that time, right? So I know that we haven't exited a deal yet. We've done some refinancing together, but I see that the track records are moving nicely, and I see how you manage things well. So I'm very comfortable with it. But I think that Kent was a good person for you to select as a partner, and him vice versa. You both come with different things, because the truth is, as we know, that cliche, right? If two people are exactly the same and they have the same opinion, one of them is not necessary, okay? And I think that you and Kent are so different in many ways, you know, background, growing up, age, personality, and so forth, that that actually is a plus, right? You look at every battery that runs a car. Isn't there a negative and a positive? They're just very different, but they work well together. So I think that's very important, and I think that's worked well for Lone Star.
Yeah, and I wanted to make sure that he got some shine here because, of course, you guys are both very important there, but I feel like Kent sometimes is the unthought-about partner, and he maybe wants it to be that way. I don't know, but I think it's just really important to reaffirm his just massive importance.
You know what? I don't look back, but had Kent not been in the mix, would I have gone with Rob? I don't know. I'd have to say possibly not because there wasn't enough depth there, okay? So I think that he added that right away to me. And I want you to know something. Even my sons, you mentioned that Phil is that now I have three sons who work with me, is that I'm trying to give them some of that because when people meet them, somebody wants to meet me, right? They want to meet somebody with a little bit more experience, and I'm trying to give them that more experience. So I'm needed less, right?
Without a doubt. And we like to parlay, you know, Kent as well. And when I speak with, you know, folks who similarly, as a director of business development, they see me in the picture and like, oh, who's this 20-year-old guy with a baby face? It's like, oh, don't you worry. There's some seasoned people with a couple grays in their hair. And I joke, yeah, the oldest member, he's so old, he's 40, which is, of course, we alluded to, not old at all. But it is certainly something that I have to mention and state because that does make people feel very comfortable.
Right. So you had mentioned that in 2022, when we were looking to buy some deals, we had some problems because the markets were moving, right? So my own personality, and I got it from my father, which is don't take no for an answer.
Tenacious.
Yeah, it is. Don't take no for an answer. And there's just, you know, and that I worked very closely with Kent on that. And he allowed me, meaning that Kent was comfortable enough, right, to allow me to jump in the driver's seat a little bit. To call the lender, show them my balance sheet, tell them what we should do, and so forth. Because Kent was mature enough to say, oh, well, Alan, you know, Rob's in his 20s, I'm in my 40s, Alan's in his 60s. So Kent didn't say, hey, you know, we got this. He said, we're having a problem. The markets are changing. If you could add your expertise, your contacts, your balance sheet, your personality, do it. Right? And he did, and it worked out for all of us. I admired that. A, it allowed me to help. And number two is there was no ego in the room. And that is huge, right? You sometimes think about boardrooms, or the boardroom, or the White House, whatever. You don't want to have egos in that room. You want to have people who give ideas and suggestions. So I was really admired Kent there, right? So he was very helpful to us there.
That was a crazy experience.
You want to give a little more color? Yeah, please do.
Yeah,
if
sure.
If you can.
Yeah, as much as we can. But we, you know, Kent and I starting the firm, like any startup, is going to go through many challenges. And we felt like we were going from one massive challenge to the next, and which definitely helped build up a tougher skin and build confidence. And so when we bumped into those issues in 2022, when basically the capital markets were very uncertain, lending terms were changing rapidly, and we were involved in a couple deals together that basically at the 11th hour.
Literally, two weeks before the closing?
One in less than a week.
Right. The bank said we're not doing it.
Unbelievable. So lenders walking away from the deal in a week or so. And, you know, I remember the bad news came on two consecutive Fridays, and I just remember going, oh, well, I guess we don't have a lender. And I had definitely a lot of concern, and I was freaking out, but I also had this inner confidence because we had been there before. I had no idea how we were going to solve the issue, and I didn't solve the issue. You did. And I remember taking the back seat and watching you step up and not take no for an answer. And that was a really good lesson for me because, frankly, I was prepared to just hear no and try to find another solution. But your solution was, no, 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 I'm not going to take no, and I'm going to ask for your superior. I'm going to plead my case. I'm going to find a creative solution. And we did.
So for two reasons. Number one is I don't like taking no for an answer. Number two is I was doing a 1031, okay? And that was my deal, okay? So if we didn't do this deal, my 1031 would have gone bust and would have cost me a lot of money. And number two is I called the executive vice president of the bank who we had met, and I basically said to him very clearly, if you're leaving the market and closing up the bank and you're going bankrupt or you're just shutting down, I get that. But if you're in the industry and you're just reevaluating your books and you plan to do loans again, you have to do this one because your reputation will be soured in the market if you shut down a week before closing. No one ever will do a business with you again. That is called retrading, and you don't do that. And if you hear me, then you should take it to your committee. And if you don't hear me, I'm not stopping. I'm going to reach out to the president of your bank and say that the PR will kill you that you did this to us. And he said to me, and I also said to him, I will put some more money up if you need it. I will show you my balance sheet. I will do what you need to feel more comfortable. But you need to do this deal. In 48 hours, he came back to us and said to us, we'll do the deal with a small modification. And it's a modification we could live with. It wasn't crazy.
We could live with it. And then, to put a cherry on top, during this whole scramble, we're trying to solve for two things. We're trying to solve for a new lender or a new loan, and we need an adjustment on the purchase price because the market's changed. So we go back to the seller and we say, we need a substantial discount on the price because the market's changed. And, you know, I'm saying this looking back, you know, happy about the outcome, but obviously we're not trying to brag about taking advantage of a seller or retrading or anything like that. But this was truly how it happened. How it happened was we didn't have a lender. We needed to go back to the market. The market had changed. We went to the seller. We got a nice discount, millions of dollars off the price. And then Alan got the lender back to the table.
Basically at the same terms.
Basically at the same terms, which at that now point in time, because the market was changing so rapidly, we're now a better than market terms. So we had a nice deal put together there all in, and we could live with the adjustments.
All right. So if you have to say, you know, it's almost like whether it be social relationships, dating, marriage, or whatever, or even in war, you develop a relationship with people, and you see how they, you know, under stress, and how they react, and how they respond. And I feel that, you know, Park Row Equity Partners and Lone Star Capital had, you know, gone to the mat a couple of times. I mean, I think the last deal we did was smooth, but most deals were bumpy, and it's how we handle the bumps. And it's also how our lawyers handle it, right? And therefore, it bonds you. It bonds you. There's a degree of respect and a degree of trust, and it works out for both of us.
I think we've talked about this before, but I'd like to hit on these two things. There's two lessons that you've told me and has been mentioned publicly at the summit as well in 2022 when this was a little bit more fresh. You learned two lessons from this experience, and I would like for everyone to hear those lessons if you don't mind sharing. And I know what they are, so I'll check you on this if you're not honest on these, but I'd be curious to know if you'd be willing to share.
Well, because of your smirk, I'll call it, I know what one of the lessons is, but I'm not sure what the other one is. So going back to the first deal that we closed with Park Row, I remember I was actually at your house in Phoenix. So I was out of the office. But nonetheless, I was in the backyard. We finally closed. I was excited. And I remember, I think I might have texted you or something, or you texted me and you said, are we closed? And I said, yep, we're closed. And then I think we got in the car and we went to lunch. And then I got back to the backyard, I'm doing some emails, and you call me and you say, you know, when you close a deal with a partner, you call them and you say, hey, congrats, we're closed, great working with you. And that was, you know, sounds like a simple thing, but it was such a valuable lesson, number one, because you were willing to give it, because you could have just gotten ticked off and gone, you know what, Rob didn't even call me after this closing, well, he's ungrateful. And you could have moved on, but you decided to actually vocalize it to me, which is the best gift you could have given. And luckily for me, I was smart enough to internalize it and definitely learn from that. So that's the thing that comes to
mind
for me.
That's lesson number one. Lesson number two was kind of what Alan went through right there, was you won't take no for an answer moving forward. So can you explain to everyone how this experience with an incredible partner shifted your mindset and also your paradigm pertaining to transactions moving forward?
Yeah, it's just a recap of what we've been talking about. When you hit a bump in the road or you hear a no, it just doesn't necessarily mean no, actually. You need to find the decision maker, you need to plead your case, and you need to be prepared to negotiate. I think that's the thing, is there, you know, especially banks, they can be quite rigid. They've got their parameters, and if you don't fit in the box, then it doesn't work. But at the end of the day, business and real estate and lenders are all just collections of people. And if you can appeal to the people, then you can make things happen.
You know, what's interesting, a lot of people say that their lawyers kill deals, right? Because they are trying to remove all risk. I have been blessed. As I mentioned earlier, there's an attorney out of Atlanta, Andy Pruzak, who basically is a businessman and a lawyer at the same time, as you've dealt with him. And he's just creative. And, whatever there's a bump, how do you figure it out? How do you make it work? And whatever deal I do, they all love him because it's a deal that he figures out a way. And we work together and figure out a way. There's just another way, okay? If it's not this way, it's that way, and so forth. And therefore, it's a tremendous amount of comfort that I'm not going to get one of these Friday afternoon calls saying, "Ah, checkmate, can't do it," right? And it's very important. In anything, especially when you have 1031 money. Generally, anytime, because even if a deal goes bust and doesn't close on anything, there's money to be lost, there's bad feelings with investors and so forth, but you don't want that to happen, right? And that's very important. And so
it seems like one of the themes we've gone through is, you know, being flexible, being creative, and being nimble. Speaking of being nimble, you've obviously made a lot of great pivots throughout your investing career and obviously, you know, your personal career. Naturally, as the nation changes, as laws have changed, you have, you know, moved out of different states. You've been open-minded. So what are some of the crucial pivots over the years that you've done to stay on the cutting edge and to generate profits and returns for your clients as, you know, nothing is ever, you know, staying still?
What's interesting is, so I look back on my real estate career of 40 years, right? The first 30 years was in New York and basically commercial office space, and the last 10 years in multifamilies, right? So if you would have asked me this question, let's say 20 years ago, I would have said, "I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?" Right? But now that you ask me, there's two elements. One is the laws that change in certain cities, and I'm not necessarily a political person, but I have a map in my office of where we have properties all over the country, right? So when people come into my office, I show it to them, and they say to me, "Oh, my God, look at that map," right? It's all different colors. You know, Colorado is a little brown, and New York's a little this, that. And I said, the truth is now it's become that there are two, you know, red states and blue states, right? And therefore, I generally would not invest in a state that is Democratic, because it's not that, you know, here I live in one, but I do believe I'm a Democrat registered. I voted Republican and Democrat over the years. I vote for the best candidate, okay? But the Democratic Party and those in power genuinely are trying to help people and generally are trying to help tenants. First of all, there are more tenants who vote than landlords, right? But they're trying to make life better for them. And when they change laws to try to help the tenants, it actually winds up hurting them, right? And when they change the laws, it also makes it less profitable for landlords. So therefore, we talked about sports earlier today. So if we were going to go play ball together, we understand what the rules of the game are, right? But how would you like it if you and I were going to go play a basketball game, right? And during the middle of the game, I said, no, your hoop is now going to go to 12 feet and my hoop is going to go to 6 feet, you know, that type of thing. So I find in some Democratic states, they change the laws, and therefore, how do you underwrite that, right? You can't underwrite that, right? So it's very hard. So therefore, I try not to. I have properties now in Colorado that are purple states, right? And there are some laws that are changing. So that's number one. And with reference to markets, you know, people are asking me, and I do admire, that's another thing about Lone Star. I have been buying property. I buy three or four deals a year. And I've been doing three or four years deals a year for the past 10 years. And people say to me, oh, we haven't done anything in the past year and a half. They haven't 2 years, right? We haven't done anything because interest rates are going so high. I said, what? What do you mean interest rates are going so high? So you underwrite it based on that rate and you try to figure it out. I said, it's not great. We all like lower interest rates. I said, when I first got into the market, right? So now I'm going to date you guys, right? So I was a commodity trader, but I still started to invest some money. My first deal was in 1985. Google 1985. Interest rates were 10, 12, 13, 14%. Okay, they were coming off. They used to be at 20%. So I bought real estate in 1985, and I bought it. It was interest rates like at 15%. So I and variable rates were like 10 and a half and 12. And I bought my first investment property with that. How did that work out? Worked out very nicely. I made money. So, you know, when I was a commodity trader, they used to say, you know, if I lent you money at 20%, can you make money? Sure, if I could lend it to somebody else at 25%. So you have to shift a little bit in terms of your expectations and your underwriting and your pricing. You can make money. I don't think these interest rates are so high. They're higher, but not in my lifetime. I remember when I bought my first house or investment property, my mother said, oh, back in the 50s, we bought houses at 7% interest rates. And we were at like 12. I said, wow, that's pretty good. Now my children are buying houses and they say 7% is so high, right? So it's all relative. So, and I've continued to buy properties, right? Sell and buy, and that's what it is. And I want you to know something. You guys, I think you're smart. I think I'm smart because the truth is in 5 years from now, people are going to look back and say, oh, well, we should have bought, you know, people say that, they tell you that joke. Oh, I should have bought a property in New York 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And you ask them why they didn't buy it. What's their reason? Too expensive. Right. Too expensive, right?
So you make the mistake again and again and again?
Yes.
Well, one of the funniest memes on that point, this is more of a millennial meme, I would say, or a Gen Z meme. It was like, what was I doing in third grade when I wasn't buying property in 2008? You know, it was kind of silly, obviously.
Right. So, you know, I have pictures of my Ira, my son. My youngest son is playing now in the office with him, working in the office with him. I have a picture of him playing Monopoly. Right? We played Monopoly in the house. I didn't tell my kids to go into real estate. I just lived by example. And isn't that true how any of us should live our lives? Just live by example, and eventually they did migrate to it.
Right. Well, and then actually one of the things I wanted to mention was, and a perfect segue is, you know, obviously you alluded to this in kind of the start and the introduction to this show, but family. You're a big, big family man. You're very, very big in your community, of course, and I think that's really true to you and your core and Park Row Equity as, you know, a whole. What's it like for you working with your family now as your children in the business and whatnot? Because I know that's probably really special for someone like yourself.
What's interesting is that it is very special. When you meet somebody and they have a son in the business or a brother in the business, they say, how does that work out, right? So I appreciate it, when I show up at a Lone Star conference and I show up with three sons in the business, or if you check out my website, how does that work, right? It is very special. And when I go to work with the three of them, it doesn't feel like I'm going to work. It feels like I'm just getting together with my sons and this is what we're doing. So, and there are some days that are a little difficult because I have to, prickly, because I have to be a father and I have to be a boss, right? Or a supervisor, that type of thing. But we seem to work it out. And I try to be fair. So I think that's fascinating. And, you know, it's really when I started in the real estate, it really is a family business. Like I said, my father passed away, but my mother owned it. And I enjoyed working for my mother because I was helping her. I was rewarding her for what she did for me. So I was helping her live a good life and live a much better life. So now we have like three generations, and it's really fascinating. Yeah, it really, really is. And so people ask me at your conference and other places, well, how do you do that? how do you get your kids involved in the business? I said, well, probably don't tell them to come into the business and don't train them to come into the business. Just tell them they could do what they want to do and live your life and let them live their life and see if there's a migration later on. If there is, that's a blessing. If it isn't, nobody'll be happy. You know, you almost feel bad for the kid who grows up in middle America and has to be forced into the family business and he doesn't like doing it, or he has to, you know, he's got to be in the union because his father in the coal mine type of thing, and they're doing it because their father did it, yeah. Right? Because they don't know any differently. So I think that's really been fascinating. I've enjoyed working with my mother. I'm sorry I never had the opportunity to work with my father. I work in his shadow. I stand on his shoulders. But I had the pleasure of working with my mother and reporting to her. A lot of these good decisions that I've made over the years, my mother pushed me. My mother was, you know, you think, oh, my mother, a small, petite, Jewish, Hebrew school teacher. She used to say to me, you don't have the killer instinct.
Sharp words from a smaller person.
Right. She used to say, buy another one. Buy another one. Push it. She would be pushing me up the hill. And there was a time at the beginning I said, no, we don't have enough cash. I don't know what I'm doing. And she would push me and encourage me. And into her late 80s and 90s, she would travel around the country with me, visiting these properties. And the people would love her. They would call her Miss Pearl. So, you know, in Atlantans, whatever. So
maybe why she got such an applause at Phil's wedding when she came out.
That's correct.
Never had to stand up and look for where is everyone clapping?
And there's something really special about your mother and Pearl. So would you please tell the story of maybe a particular development in the financial district that is a memento to her?
Yeah. So we had these two buildings, one building and then another right next to each other in Lower Manhattan. And in 2014, we thought that we decided to develop them on our own. And I knew it would take a period of time to not only develop them, a number of years, and it would then to cash out and so forth. It would take some time. And at the time, my mother was in her mid-80s, and we were always making a living, but I had a feeling that this was going to pop. The building was going to work, and I just felt it. We were on the threshold of doing something great. The building was going to be beautiful, and the multifamily is going to work out, and we were going to go from middle income to upper income fast. But I did think that, and I said, Ma, I don't know how long you're going to live, and I don't know if you're going to see the opening of this building. And her name is Pearl, and I made it a requirement to any developer that they would have to call the building the Pearl on the Park. Now, my mother's name could have been Shirley, right? And that sounds silly, Shirley.
That's my grandma's name.
Is it really?
Yeah, okay, it is, right. Yeah.
No, that's a generational thing. Yeah. But that would
Recipes
sound silly.
Recipes my grandma, I love you.
Okay. Say hello to your grandma for me. But Shirley on the Park sounds like a movie. It doesn't sound like but the Pearl on the Park sounds beautiful because it's a name. It's also a description, right? And it was a requirement. Any developer would have to name it the Pearl on the Park, because I said, Mom, I'm not sure you're going to live to see the building being built, but you should know your legacy on Park Row will last forever. The name Pearl will always be here, and you'll always be part of it. And I said, let's see what happens. And sure enough, she saw the being built, and she's been in the building, and she was at the ground opening, and she was at the... And my mother, like I said, is 98 years old. Not as sharp as she used to be, but just a few years ago, she was at the building. We would travel the country. So when I walk past that building, there it is, the Pearl on the Park. And yes, the original plan was for our offices to be back there, right? But because of the office space and the retail is so expensive that we had the option to come back in. It's an interesting play. Is why do I have an option? Why don't I own it? I was going to own it at a high market value. It was over $20 million between the retail and why? Is because my lawyer, very smart guy, Jeff Kaufman from Herrick, said to me, but what happens if the developer goes bust? If the developer goes bust, you will lose that equity. We don't want that. So why don't we just sell everything out and you have the option to come in at a price? You may have to pay a little bit more in transfer tax, but you'll make that up on your multifamilies. So ultimately, that was a brilliant thing, because otherwise I would have gotten, the developer didn't go under, but I would own the office space now and the retail space that unfortunately is still empty, as opposed to having the option, and I didn't exercise the option, and therefore I saved huge amounts of money.
So do you have a deed restriction then on the property to make sure the name is, you know, indefinitely?
It's not, it's not part of the deed, but it's part of the condo association.
Okay.
Right. So
but it can never change over time, hopefully.
I don't know. You know what's interesting? That's a very good question. I don't think it can. It would be hard. It's a great name and so forth. But I didn't necessarily want or need it to be named Pearl on the Park forever. I needed it to be named Pearl on the Park for my mother's forever.
Right.
And that is accomplished. And it's there. And it's got a good reputation. So that's the hope and dream that it stays that way. But we'll have to see.
When we walk back from Barclay Rex quite often, we walk by that building, and I think about you and your mother all the time. I don't know if you knew that, but it is really special to think about that. And it's really beautiful that you've solidified your family's name and legacy and homage to your mother with that building there. So I really tip the cap to you for being so thoughtful in that regard. That's truly remarkable and special.
And it shows you that when you have a plan, everything doesn't have to work out exactly perfectly. Nobody has to have everything, right? So the plan was for us to be back in that office. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I don't know. My sons don't even use the office that much as more. You know, everything is electronic and Zoom and so forth. Now, you know, Donnie's in Cleveland and so forth. So don't know, but, you know, when you think about from a J&R leaving, our major tenant leaving, and I had a get a new tenant or not get a new tenant, develop it or not develop it, all the decisions that I made over the past 10 years and how the market's changed in so many ways that I'm still standing in a much better situation than I am. There's a degree of luck, and therefore if I didn't hit everything, if I'm not sitting in that office, in that building, then so be it. But I think under the circumstances, I did pretty well and my family did very well.
Really cool story, and I really wanted to emphasize that because, you know, outside of all the deals and the money we hopefully make together, to tell that story on this forum is really special.
You know,
and needed to be shared.
I don't know if I did, but my mother, very smart, gave me a lot of good advice. One of the things she did do is in her early 90s, she wrote a book with and in there there's a few chapters called Pearl on the Park. And it's about the development of Lower Manhattan and so forth. So I'll have to share that book with you. It's really quite interesting.
I would love a signed copy by the author, please, actually. That would be crucial before.
I will, I will get you that for your Lone Star Library. Because it's the journey of her life. And my mother, thank God, is still with us. But she gave everybody a lot of advice. And she was like, didn't necessarily wait for you to ask for advice. She gave advice, and after a while I kept listening to it, and it was good advice, and I took her advice, and it worked out very well for both of us and actually for my entire family.
So it's really special.
I'm hoping that she gets to play this for her and hope she'll understand it
without
and listen
doubt.
It so
well if she does, hello. I will hope to meet you at some point if possible, but very special that we got to share
thank
that
you.
story, because I think that people really should hear that, and that story should live on for an eternity. So
yeah,
thank you.
It has to do with showing appreciation. She made the decision that I took the office space. Just lots of decisions. We could do a whole segment on Pearl and Pearl on the Park, but I do appreciate her, and I do appreciate that is a core value of mine. In Hebrew, there's an expression "hakarat hatov," meaning appreciation for those who helped you. Right. So if somebody's done right for you, you always show appreciation. Right. Going back to that, it's really important. I believe that because we're only here because our parents did something right, alive and educated us and so forth. And then there's other people who do things for you that you should show appreciation. And I'm able to show appreciation, and I couldn't show it to my father. So I'm absolutely drown my mother in appreciation.
That's really special.
Yeah. I try to do it to my wife now and my kids and as well.
Right. So speaking of appreciation, I would like to wrap it up with a couple more concepts, but how do you find new partners, or maybe new partners find you? And then how does someone earn your trust, respect, and business?
Right. So
and now I can close the laptop.
Right. Okay. So when you say partners, I imagine you mean like investing partners, like sponsors, right? So how do I find them? So Rob told you the way, which was brilliant. So I may be his best find, you know, through my son in terms of the relationship. I don't know, and hopefully it's not. Hopefully you'll get bigger. But I go to places, or I send my son to conferences and so forth, and word of mouth, right? I meet people, right? Somebody recommended me to people and so forth. So that's how I would meet sponsors, right? By meeting people at certain conferences and word of mouth. That's how I meet them. That's how I meet these potential sponsors, right? And to be honest with you, you know, and I'll say this for your audience, other than Lone Star, who just is focused, and it makes sense. Texas is huge, bigger than most countries. Other than Lone Star focusing on just Texas, we would do a lot more business together. My business model is the country, right, and the diversification of the United States. For many reasons, in addition to I happen to like to travel and see the country, and it's just a diversification. Otherwise, we would, you know, do a lot more business, right? I wouldn't need any other sponsor, in my opinion, what you guys are doing, your business model. I would even consider merging with you guys, okay? I just like it. But I feel that I need to diversify. So, and I think that probably in the future, we will do, Park Row Equities will be a hybrid, meaning that we'll be doing some deals with sponsors and some deals with our own, because my sons are hungry and they want to do some deals, and they will probably do some deals on their own as well. And I hybrid because my investors, which we'll get to in a second, have a tremendous appetite for deals. So therefore, if I did a deal on my own, maybe I'll do one deal a year or two deals. But if I have a number of sponsors, I have, let's say, you know, I have a lot of shoes to sell. If somebody comes into my shoe store, I have this one, I get that one. And therefore, it also helps them in 1031s. I have different people that I could do business with. So that's how I find sponsors. And how do... the question was,
it was pertaining to how does someone earn your business trust and respect?
I'd have to say that first of all, reputation. Reputation management, as that expression is, I check people out carefully. I do diligence. You know, what's interesting is that there were a major broker company in the city. Massey Nackel was the biggest one in the city. Actually, they sold out after my deal. They sold out in December of 2014. And I was dealing with Paul Massey at the time, and also some underlings of his. And biggest company in the city, Massey Nackel, 2,000 deals a year. And do you know that I did my due diligence on them? I called people on them. I went to visit people on them. And he says, "You're really checking me out." I said, "Yeah, because I don't want to get it wrong." So reputation is very important, very important. That's how they earn it. How do they maintain my business is by transparency, just communicating, be in touch with me, let me know what's going on. Hopefully it's all always good news. Whatever the news, let me know what's going on and be in touch with me. That's how I like it, right? So if you guys were on a plane, right, and you're going through turbulence, wouldn't you have liked to heard before the turbulence the pilot said, "Oh, for the next 10 minutes we're going to have turbulence and then we'll be fine." Oh my God, that's great. No big deal. First of all, now you know the pilot's expecting it. Number two is, it's going to be over soon. But how would you like to hear the pilot isn't talking to you? Now you're going through turbulence. You don't know what it is. Okay? It's not so comfortable. Both of them are the same situation, but it's how it's communicated, right? So that's how it's maintained. Communication with me is how transparency is what that's like. And also there's likability. At my stage of life, I can pick and choose who I want to do business with, right? Who I like to do business with and whose company I enjoy. I could choose whoever I want to do business with. And how do I do it? There are people who, just before a closing, if I need to ask something, and they don't like how I ask. If I want to ask something about, you know, the promote structure, or if I want to ask something about the closing, or if I need some more equity, you know, post-closing even. I'm tongue-in-cheek because that's with Rob. I asked him recently. I was in Colorado and we had closed the deal and I had so many investors, some new investors, and I didn't want to say no to them. And I was running out of equity because I like to have skin in the game. It's very important to me. I relay that and I called and I said, and any time that I call you, whether you agree with me or not agree with me, cool as a cucumber, right? Very cool. And Kent as well. And it's just a pleasure. I've had sponsors yell at me, okay? Scream at me, okay? Because I'm asking a question or I'm questioning something or they're accusing me of something. mean, who needs this, right? Hot. There are hot people out there, right? Because of the stress of a closing and so forth. So I don't like doing that. So I feel that the people that I do business with, one of the reasons that I'm up here, I enjoy spending time with you guys. You know, you're smart, you're young, you're aggressive, you're bright, all good things, right? And you're in this industry and you happen to be, you know, we made a joke, you know, I used to say you're a nine iron away from my office when you're a few blocks away. It's very close. Right. So that's how people keep it, by having a good relationship and keeping a transparency and being upfront and being natural and enjoying each other's company, whether it be here in the office or at the golf club or
I have actually one more. I was waiting for that. It was on the tip of my tongue, right. And I want this to be shared.
Talk about transparency.
Yes, yeah. You saw that he's in quite good shape. So
right,
with that said,
right.
Well, hold on. Let me just really quickly go back to your story about the recent closing we had, where you called me and you said I've got some bad news on the equity on this deal, and I oh no, what is it? I need to put more money into the deal.
God forbid.
Right. And we were just so happened that we were just full on this deal. Just full. We had overcommitted ourselves.
I felt it.
We were bursting. And I told you no. I said, no, we don't have the room. And then you told me, well, you know, I'm really disappointed to hear that.
Did I say that?
Yeah. And you said,
oh, my God. There he goes again. Yeah. This guy won't take no for an answer. Right,
exactly. Right. And you explained why it was, because you just asked. And I said, you know, we're actually full. Right. But then you explained, no, this is actually really important to me because these are new investors and I need to show them a quality experience. I need to get them in. And then, of course, hearing that, I went and made it work, right? And that's what a partnership's about, having that transparency and that open communication.
Right. Yeah. Right. So with that said, if I'm not mistaken, my memory does serve me quite well quite often, and you wanted to see Rob outside of the Rob Beardsley uniform, which for everyone who knows, Rob essentially goes to bed, works out, wakes up, and showers in a suit and tie.
Right.
So you wanted to see him maybe in a different frame and dynamic.
Right. So in Lower Manhattan, and also there is a Rob's family is a little Russian history, right? Your mother, your grandmother, whatever, okay? So right between our two offices, you wouldn't believe it. In Lower Manhattan, it's the Russian bathhouse, right? And it's underground in Fulton Street. It's like a cave, right? Like a cave, like a bat cave, right? And we've gone there many times, and it's just a chill place, right? It's got a steam room, it's got a a sauna, it's got a pool, it's food, it's drinks, it's just a great thing, and it's a Russian bathhouse. So I said, you know what? Rob's got to chill a little. Why don't we invite him as our guest to go down there and enjoy it, right? And obviously, you not only have to take off your tie, you have to take off your shirt, you have to take all your clothes.
Well, you could go with a suit and tie. It might look a little bit bizarre, but one could. But
I mean, basically, you know, you strip
nothing
down,
to hide.
Nothing to hide, okay? Right. Okay? And
he sees all of his tattoos, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And it's a way to bond.
Right.
And at first, I thought he wouldn't go for it, and you did, and it was great. And I think you've been there after that.
Oh yeah, I love that place. I actually took him for the first time over the weekend.
There you go. It's a great place.
What was when we walk in? Because I told him, hey, it's the Russian bathhouse. But in his mind, he thought it was a spa.
Right.
So he thought it's this nice, luxurious experience. And then he gets down there and he goes, I'm in this cave. This is not what I expected.
Right. But what's amazing though is where it is. Right. It's in Lower Manhattan on Fulton Street. Right. You wouldn't expect it. It was another great experience to bond that way, right?
The comment that you made in the sauna, you said we were all sitting around there with.
I thought what happens in the sauna stays in the sauna.
Yeah, that's Vegas. And the saunas, I suppose.
Well, just this one comment, you said, I bet there's not a single sponsor and equity partner around the country right now that are celebrating a closing at a Russian bathhouse like this.
That's correct. That's correct, right? It's a question of enjoying life, right, and having a good experience, right? So,
you mentioned this as well, and it's the pleasure of it's just something that you're doing. You just happen to be working. Well, I share a similar feeling day in and day out by working with my best friend.
Right.
It is the most special thing ever. That although at times he might crack the whip on me every now and then, but I'd like to think that I'm always in line and respectful. But it's a very interesting dynamic where how do you manage best friend and also boss who's younger than me?
Right.
So my ego was checked at the door when I worked with the firm to get in here to start. But I can really appreciate that concept of working with your friends or your family and whatnot, because if it is true and special like that and you can make it work, there's nothing more special. And I truly wake up every single day excited, thrilled, and grateful for the opportunity I have here currently. But I've also grown to be very good friends with Dasha, with Ina, with Todd, and the whole Beardsley family. It's like my second family, but also the whole firm itself. It feels very special that I truly don't feel like I'm working. I feel like this is not a real job.
You know, what's interesting, it goes back to a very... I use metaphors like the plane, right? They say that you can get a horse to move. You can get a horse to move in two ways. One is you can whip that horse. You whip that horse because buggy whips and so forth. You can get that horse to run. Another way is you give the horse a little sugar and the horse will also move. And I find that if you create it, and I see that you have that here, if you create a nice work environment and you have fun while doing it, you actually, maybe you waste a little time during the day, true, but the time that you're working is so much more productive, right? The big picture. And I think if you have that environment here, you're very fortunate. And in my office, I always say we try to have some fun. If we're not having fun, then why come to work, right? And we're very fortunate to be able to do that, right? So
what,
maybe that's why there is a nice synergy between our...
Yeah. So what is next for you, for the team, for your children, maybe on a personal or business level, whatever you're willing to share as we cap off this episode? We've held you hostage for long enough.
Well, I'd have to say for me is that my role is to share my experience with my sons so that they are comfortable in managing and growing the business from an investment standpoint. That's what I think. And I think the direction should be that they should try to do some deals on their own and continue with sponsors, right? I think that's beautiful for our investors. And I think our investors like that. I think that's the future where we go. Because even if we don't do deals, just like I said, we sell deals, all of a sudden it's like one deal can turn into three deals and three deals can turn into nine deals. It grows. So I think from the standpoint, as much as I love this, and I do love doing what I'm doing, I don't feel like the past 40 years I ever really came to work. I just enjoy doing it. First working by myself, literally, with a building manager and working for my mother and my kids. I've been blessed that way. But I do know that we all have a certain time to get off the stage, right? That, you know, I'm 65 years old. I'm in relatively good health. Made a lot of money in real estate. I think I should be spending a little bit more time visiting my grandchildren, going on cruises, playing golf courses throughout the world, not just the United States, because as we all know, nobody's immune. My health is going to change, and I will not live forever. Why wait until I'm 80? A friend of mine is a lawyer, and his partner said, you know, at 80, he was going to retire and move down to Orlando, right? And he could have 10, 15 years down there because a lot of people live to their 80s and 95. Guess what? He retired at 80 and died at 81, you know? I mean, I don't know what that's going to be. So I want to have a different venue, you know? I mean, I enjoyed college, but I was only there for 4 years, right? So I couldn't stay there much longer. We all have to move on. So I feel that part of me needs to move on because I want to look back on my life when I hopefully am older and say, okay, I did this, I did this, I did this, and I did this. I don't necessarily want to die with my boots on. I don't want to die in my office when I'm 85. There are people who do it, who work. I'd like to be involved in some way if they still need me, but I'd like to enjoy. I just last year, I joined a country club, which I never thought I could afford and never thought that I'd be able to enjoy it. And I invited you guys to enjoy it with me. I enjoy doing things like that. And I think that that's part of life. So I want to enjoy that. So I think, therefore, if God gives me good health, that there should be a transition, that I should be in the office less, and my children, my sons, and Renat, and other people who work for me should be able to continue this because it serves the family very well. And we have a lot of investors, and it serves them as well. They feel us. They like our comfort level, and they're doing well. So I think that's the future of Parkrow Equity Partners.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for being a friend to us, a mentor to us, a partner to us, and being part of the Lone Star family and ecosystem. I'm sure many people, Ilya Gamer was actually specifically requesting and waiting for the show. So shout out to Ilya for being on the episode before this. But we look very forward to releasing this to the world. But before we do let you go, if someone wants to invest with you, work with you guys in the future, present you a deal potentially, how can people find you and reach out to you and the family and the Park Row team?
Well, generally, we have an email or a website, parkrowequitypartners.com. They should look for that. And I think that that would be helpful, and they'll see what we are, and they'll see our generational thing and around the country, and they'll appreciate what we do, is that we are very careful with people's money, because I remember that when I had a small amount of money, how valuable it is. And even though I can afford to lose money now, I don't look at that as something, because I can't afford to lose any other people's money. And as that cliche goes, we all work hard for our money at Park Row Equity Partners. We make sure your money works hard for you.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
I thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Great pleasure.
For the audience, for listening, we appreciate you tuning in, and we'll see you next week.